Thank you, Kara. You know, God cares about each one of us, and God wants to use each one of us where we are, where he's put us. We have this idea that there's a hierarchy of people. There's the special people that God wants to use for big things, and then there's the other people he wants to use for some things, and then there's the rest of us, and we're like, well, I guess I'll stick you somewhere, but, you know, I've forgotten you. God made you on purpose, in the spot where he put you on purpose, to reach the people around you on purpose, and that person that you think would do a better job, he didn't put there, he put you there on purpose. And that's because he sees who we are, and he knows who we are, and he cares about who we are, and he wants to use us on purpose. None of us are bigger than anybody else. We're all just us, and he's just God, and if we follow him, he can do great things in our life. Hey, we're going to be in Psalm chapter 30 today. Psalm chapter 30. This is going to be kind of more of an encouraging message this evening in Psalm chapter 30. And so once you get there, I want us to read through it. We have to start at the introduction to the psalm before we get into the rest of it, because that's very, very important to what we see. This is a psalm of David, and so it's really helpful to see a situation where his life is, and so we're gonna be applying that today to us this evening. Verse number 1 of Psalm chapter 30, it says, first of all, a psalm and song at the dedication of the house of David. So that's important. Verse number 1, I will extol thee, O Lord, for thou hast lifted me up and hast not made my foes to rejoice over me. O Lord, my God, I cried unto thee, and thou hast healed me. O Lord, thou hast brought up my soul from the grave. Thou hast kept me alive that I should not go down to the pit. Sing unto the Lord, O ye saints of his, and give thanks at the remembrance of his holiness. For his anger endureth but for a moment, and his favor is life. Weeping may enjoy for a night, but joy cometh in the morning. And in my prosperity I said, I shall never be moved. Lord, by thy favor thou hast made my mountain to stand strong. Thou didst hide thy face, and I was troubled. I cried unto thee, O Lord, and unto the Lord I made supplication. What profit is there in my blood when I go down to the pit? Shall the dust praise thee? Shall it declare thy truth? Hear, O Lord, and have mercy upon me. Lord, be thou my helper. Thou hast turned for me my mourning into dancing. Thou hast put off my sackcloth and girded me with gladness, to the end that my glory may sing praise to thee and not be silent. O Lord, my God, I will give thanks unto thee forever. Now, at first glance, this psalm is very typical of David. David brings up a lot of themes that he often writes in his psalms. He talks about God hearing him after he prays to him. He praises God for his goodness and his long-suffering, and he's real about his own life. But what's extremely important about this psalm is two major parts to it that seem awkward to go together. The first one is why he's writing this in the first place. It says the psalm was at the dedication of the house of David. Now, we know about this. This story is already written down in the Bible, 2 Samuel chapter 5. You don't have to turn over there. But during the passage of 2 Samuel chapter 3-ish to chapter 10, it's really just outlining all of the victory and the progress and the prosperity of David's kingdom. The very beginning, after Saul dies, there's turmoil between him and the house of David, and there's war, but David waxes stronger and stronger, and the house of Saul waxes weaker and weaker. And then for chapters, it outlines, and then he fought this battle, and then there was peace, and he brought the Ark of the Covenant back, and he put it in the temple. They built a house. And in 2 Samuel chapter 5, what we see is that he made peace with the king of Tyre, which is very abnormal for the entire history of Israel. Israel is often having tensions with Tyre and Zidon. Jezebel was from Zidon, and so throughout a lot of their history, there's a lot of problems. Not during David's reign. During David's reign, there was a good king in Tyre whose name was Hiram, and he makes peace with this king, and this king chooses to send down materials. Later, he'll do the same thing for Solomon to build the temple, but now he does it for David to build his own palace. David has recently taken back Jerusalem, which was the city of Jabus, where the Jebusites were, and it was like one of the most prominent and easily defendable places in all of Israel, and so that's why they took it so late. And he set up his fort there, and then he decides to build his palace there, and cedars from Lebanon up there, down up in Tyre, are sent down, and he builds this big house, and then there's the dedication of this house. So why is that significant? Because the setting of this psalm is a very, very special day. Okay. Put that there. When you read through the psalm, the other interesting thing as you read through it is how many things David mentions that are negative. He refers to a lot of suffering and trials and difficulty and pain. Glance back at the psalm. Look at verse number 3. Thou hast brought up my soul from the grave. Thou hast kept me alive that I should not go down to the pit. Verse number 5. His anger endureth but a moment. Weeping may endure for a night. Verse number 7. At the end it says, thou didst hide thy face and I was troubled. Verse number 9. What profit is there in my blood when I go down to the pit? Shall the dust praise thee? Verse number 11. Thou hast turned for me my mourning into dancing. Thou hast put off my sackcloth and girded me with gladness. So here in this psalm, he also manages to talk about the grave, the pit, God's anger, weeping, trouble, being brought to dust, mourning, sackcloth, are also all tossed into this same psalm. But what we notice here is that it refers to the suffering in the past. And this makes perfect sense to David's story. Because if you know David's story, you know that he was not in the most glamorous situation up until 2 Samuel chapter 5. We see him just trying to do what's right. I mean, he lived outside as a shepherd, but, you know, a shepherd's life is a shepherd's life, and he was used to it. He wasn't running from anybody, so it was good. But then he goes to war. I mean, God blesses him in war, not only fighting Goliath, but fighting all the Philistines for the next few years. He blesses him in war. He's very victorious, but war is no glamorous life. He's out in caves, and he's out in the rain and in the weather with his men covered in blood and dirt. And so this was his life for a while, but God was blessing him. But, you know, there's a lot of trials and hardship through that. But obviously, the rest of his story after that is also very difficult. His own king, who he loves and serves faithfully, turns against him because he's too good. Imagine that being your problem. You're too good of a servant of the kingdom that now your king doesn't like you. And he just did what was right. Now he's running for his life. People are dying for having the audacity to help him. Good people, godly people, are suffering because of his very existence. He lives in caves. He's hiding for his life. He's running so many times. We see Psalms at this time in his life where he's saying, God, why don't you hear me? Why are my enemies still risen up? Why is it that I'm doing right and I'm in the cave and he's doing wrong and he's in the palace? That doesn't make sense. And this is David's struggle for so much of his life. But here, that's not what today is. This morning, he wakes up in a nation where he is the king and his people just really like him. This morning, he wakes up and he puts on his best robe and he opens his door to see his family, and they gather together and they're greeted by servants with a smile, and they're greeted by the people of the kingdom who are all cheering on their king. The nation's prosperous. There's peace on our borders. We're finally have things together at the moment. And David's our king, and we love him. And we're all gathering together to dedicate the palace of our king in this city that our king conquered and nobody else could. And so they walk in, and they're singing, and there's instruments, and all, he's surrounded by his people in peace. And he walks into his palace, built from materials from a king nearby that he probably wouldn't have been able to afford otherwise. And he walks in, and on this day, when all the commotion calms down, he writes this psalm. Some things are difficult. Weeping endures for a while. But joy, it comes in the morning. And God gives you these moments, just like he gives you hard moments. God brings you through trials and difficulty, but he also gives you days when you can just breathe a sigh of contentment and say, God,
has been good to me. To look around at things that you didn't earn and a life that you didn't necessarily build. And I mean, you tried to follow God and do what was right, and you can look around and say, God has been good. And that's what this psalm is, the tension between those two things. That is often what life is. You are given both days. You are given both days. It's not that God gives you good days and then bad days just smack you and he goes, well, you know, that happens. God hands you the days that you receive. And weeping endures for a while, and joy comes in the morning. I'm going to give you a few points this morning. It's the evening, I'm sorry. I'm going to give you four truths from this passage that teaches about coming and going of trials. And so I don't want this message to be long or complicated, but I think it'll be helpful tonight. Number one, first thing I notice about this psalm is this simple truth. There is always another side to your difficulty. There is always another side to your difficulty. David talks about the trials that he used to have. He talks about how he has really arrived at the other side of them. Go back in verse number one. I will extol thee, O Lord, for thou hast lifted me up and hast not made my foes to rejoice over me. Now, if you're really fast, go back to Psalm chapter 25. Psalm chapter 25. I'm just going to read one verse here. What David is often praying for is that to happen because it's not happening. You notice that? Psalm chapter 25. Look at what David says, verse number 2. Oh, my God, verse 2, I trust in thee. Let me not be ashamed. Let not mine enemies triumph over me. In this psalm, he's in the cave. This psalm, he's in the wilderness. This psalm, the wicked are in power and he's not. And he says, God, I trust you. Let not mine enemies triumph over me. But in Psalm chapter 30, he says, you have made it so that my foes don't rejoice over me. Psalm 30 is the answer to prayer of what he says in Psalm 25. He asks this because often life was bearing down on him a lot. At times he felt like he was honestly losing. I mean, if you put yourself in David's shoes throughout 1 Samuel, probably felt that way. Why aren't things going better? Shouldn't things be going better? They're not going well. And you see him just weep onto paper saying, ah, why is this my life? But I trust you. But here in Psalm 30, that's what we have. He said, you have given me that life that you had promised. Look at verse 3 of Psalm 30. You can go back from Psalm 25. Psalm 30, verse number 3, he says, Lord, thou hast brought up my soul from the grave. Thou hast kept me alive, that I should not go down to the pit. Because some days he thought he was going to die. Remember that one psalm, I think I mentioned it last time, where, I don't know when I mentioned it, but he was, I don't think I mentioned it, never mind, actually. David is running away from Saul, and Saul is chasing him, and the Ziphites are aware of David's position, where his men are, and Saul sends some messengers, and Ziphites say, oh yeah, David's up there on the mountain, you can go get him. And Saul acts real spiritual, oh bless you of the Lord, like he was on his side. Anyway, and he goes and he chases down David, and they surround him on this mountain. David is on the peak of the mountain. Saul's men are surrounding the peak of the mountain. There is no way for him to go. The only way you can go down a mountain is down. And everywhere down, there were Saul's men. And Saul wanted to kill David. That was no surprise. That was not a secret. And there's been many times where David thought, I am going to die. But here, this morning, he wakes up as king of Israel. Here, this morning, he's wearing the robes that his people have sewn for him. Here, this morning, he's going to walk into a house that his people have builded for him because God has given it to him. And he says, you have brought me out of the grave and away from the pit. There was another side to that story. Look at verse number 5. His anger endures but a moment, in his favor is life. Weeping may endure for a night, but joy cometh in the morning. Even in chastisement, there's another side to that. God does not chastise for the sake of making life difficult. He chastises for the sake of making your life better. We talk about church discipline is difficult, but the point of discipline is to restore. The end of all the storylines in the Bible often find their way through difficulty, but to a specific purpose. The way to the green pastures and still waters, Pastor always points out, goes through the valley of the shadow of death. What's interesting is Paul Bunyan, when he talks about that with Christian's story in his travels through Pilgrim's Progress, often Christian... What did I say? Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean that. John Bunyan, when he writes about Christian's story, often Christian finds himself in the wrong spot because he went off of the path. But often, he makes sure that he's very careful to have Christian go through difficult times when he's on the path, because that's reality. And one of those that he goes through is the valley of the shadow of death. And he is on the path he's supposed to be on. Right after he gets out of the wicket gate, he climbs the mountain difficulty, which is the next thing on the road. Even though there was paths around the mountain that seemed easier, the path he was supposed to go on still went up the mountain. The fact is, it's true for us. There's always another side to it. And the thing is, sometimes in our immaturity, we think it's just never going to end. When I was a child, I like thunderstorms now, but I hated thunderstorms at night. And this is a normal thing for kids, you know? I like to go and sit on the porch and watch a thunderstorm roll across the horizon. That's very soothing to me. But when you're trying to sleep and there's just the screen is rattling and the wind blows incrementally, so it's not consistent, and you have that the thunder that rolls and you don't know when it's going to come, and the flashing, and it's very hard to rest. And I remember one time when we were really little, Hurricane came by and it made its way all the way up to Maryland as a just bad storm. It wasn't a hurricane, it wasn't dangerous, we were all going to be fine, so we weren't like hiding out in the basement. He says, everybody go to sleep and the storm will pass. And I could not sleep through the storm, as if it was never going to end. Night was never going to end. It's 1 in the morning and 2 in the morning and 3 in the morning and 4 in the morning. And then for some reason, that little glimmer of morning gives you this strange sense of rest, and then I fall asleep. That was always true. Difficulty is sometimes there in the night, but joy comes in the morning. Verse 11, he says, thou hast turned for me my mourning into dancing. Thou hast put off my sackcloth and girded me with gladness. Every tear that David shed would be followed eventually by laughing and dancing. He was in a cave and cold and dark and lonely, weeping. Not today. And God gave him this day. And he reminded us that God gives us those days. Sometimes we think it's never going to end. Have you ever gotten poison ivy before? One time I got poison ivy because I was stupid. I was really under the impression that poison ivy, like oil, was only on the leaves. I don't know where I heard that, but wherever it was, they lied, or I never heard it. Because the point is, it's not only on the leaves. I slowly pulled it out, and it snapped at the root. I was like, oh, whatever. I took off my glove and grabbed it by the root and pulled it out. Do you know there's 10 times as much oil in the roots than there are on the leaves? And so for the next 2 to 3 weeks, I had poison ivy up and down the inside of every single one of my fingers on both hands. It does not spread the first few days. That's an illusion. The moment you wash your hands the first time, well, it's gone. But it will show up for the next few days, and it will run its course. And you'll be sitting on Google wondering why it won't just take your life. But the fact is, it will pass. And that's what they all say, oh, you can do this, you can make it better, this can make you endure it, but you know what? Know what makes it go away? Time. Eventually, there's another side to it. I did that with my wisdom teeth a few weeks ago. Why is it still hurting? It was supposed to go away. Is there anything wrong? Well, just come in, it's not going to cost you anything, we'll look at it. All right, what do I do, doc? Wait, just time. It'll get better. And the thing is, we are given so many situations in our life that we're under the false and immature impression that God has given us a bad hand just for the sake of it. And whether it's in this life or it's in the next one, there is always another side to our difficulty. In 1 John chapter 1, he says, now we are in heaviness through manifold temptations for a season. And for Peter in that passage, he's referring to this life as opposed to eternity. The season literally means a short time. But for Peter, he was saying, your life is short. And the difficulty that you're experiencing now and the trials and the mountains of difficulty that you'll go over and the valleys of the shadow of death that you have to walk through, even on the path of righteousness, is but for a season. And joy comes in the morning. And so rather than looking down at our feet, we have to look forward to the future God promised to us. There's always another side to your difficulty. Number two. What do we learn from this passage of this very encouraging day from David? God hears you even when he doesn't respond immediately. So how many times did David hunch over in that cave when he was alone and dark and fearing for his life and say, God, why are my enemies triumphing over me? And it didn't stop tomorrow. How many days, how many years of that did David go through? And so what do we see in this psalm? Verse number two. O Lord, my God, I cried to thee, and thou hast healed me. In this verse, there's a sense. David asked, God answered. That's what we want life to feel like. I cried, you healed. That's how we want the Christian life to always go. I learned to pray without ceasing. You're going to laugh. I learned to pray without ceasing when I was doing construction. I had no idea what I was doing. I was sometimes left to be like, okay, just take all the nails out of this wall. We're doing some demolition. We took all the drywall down. A bunch of nails are sticking out. We need to clear this. Just do all that. And so sometimes I'm in this room, I'm working, and I got my hammer, and there's so many, you're going to laugh. But this is where I learned to pray without ceasing. I'm just like, God, help me with this nail. Come on, give me the nail. Ah, okay. Yes, sometimes it's immediate. And the thing is, that helped me spiritually. But, you know, whatever works. But the thing is, sometimes it is immediate. You say, hey, God, I need this, and then he answers. Sometimes we pray for somebody in the hospital, and they get out of the hospital in the next 2 weeks. Sometimes that happens, and sometimes it doesn't. And see, what David refers to is all the times that that didn't happen. Look at verse number 8. I cried to thee, O Lord, and unto the Lord I made my supplication. And then you see him making a deal with God. Look at verse 9. What profit is there in my blood when I go down to the pit? Shall the dust praise thee? Shall it declare thy truth? Hear, O Lord, and have mercy upon me, Lord. Be thou my helper. Here you see him reminiscing about the moments where he says, God, I can't praise you if I'm dead, right? Who's going to speak the truth about you? The dirt? Can't do it then. So help me now. And those were so many moments that David had. And here, there's the other side. Putting yourself back in David's shoes, I'm sure there was a lot of times he cried to God and his situation did not change. Not right away. That's why the Bible tells us to cast our care upon him, for he careth for you. What we want to interpret from that verse is to cast our care upon him so that he can fix it right away, because he cares for us. And that's not what he said. We cast our care upon him because we can't handle it, and God can, and he will handle it correctly, but not necessarily in our way and at our time. David would never stand up and say, God answered my prayer exactly how I asked him to, because we know what prayers he prayed. We also know how he answered them, and those two did not always match. But God doesn't chide David for asking him to help a situation, but he does want David to trust him. You know, you have a problem. You got the poison ivy. God, take it away. It doesn't mean that he will. We trust God with our situations, but that doesn't mean that we require of God a certain way of handling it. God always hears you, even when he doesn't respond immediately. Number three, God's purpose is always for your good and for his glory. It is always for your good and for his glory. God does not do things to tear people apart and for his glory, and he doesn't do things for your good that don't point to him. He does both. So go back in verse number three. O Lord, thou hast brought up my soul from the grave. Thou hast kept me alive, that I should not go down to the pit. Sing unto the Lord, O ye saints of his, and give thanks at the remembrance of his holiness. He put those two together. He has given me new life. He has given me another life on the other side of all that suffering and all those trials and all those difficulties. And so we can sing to him. God has given David a new life, and David got to enjoy it. And sometimes we think that everything that God is doing to us is always to, if it's not good, then there's no purpose for it. That's how we feel. Now, we know that's not the answer in church, but that's how we feel, right? But think about this for a moment. Now, we don't always know, but let's think a little bit about David's situation. David is now king. Over the course of the last few years of suffering and trials, David has had the opportunity to not be a cushy person. He knows what it means to be out on the battlefield. He knows how to gather. He's had to learn to lead in a situation where people do not have to follow him, but choose to. David has learned to be a warrior. David has learned to be a leader. David has learned to be gracious. David has learned to be king through his suffering and trials. And so, for the sake of argument, the less of those he had, the worse of a king he might have been. But God has given him those for his good, and he can sing for it. Immature minds do not understand where something is difficult, it can possibly be for my good. Last time we went to the doctor, it was the first time Levi recognized that doctor means shot. And he knew that before he got there. They walk in with the mask. I know that guy. That guy means pain. And he looks at us like, why do you hate me? What did I do to you this morning? I thought I was good. But we can't convince him right now that just because there's pain doesn't mean it's bad. And sometimes in our immaturity, we can't see past the moment. We look at God and say, why are you doing this to me? Just because it hurts doesn't always mean it's bad. Pain is bad. Difficulties are not great. It's not necessarily the way the world was designed. We live in a cursed and broken and fallen world. But God will give us those times for our good and also for his glory. Look at verse 11. Thou hast turned for me my mourning into dancing. Thou hast put off my sackcloth and girded me with gladness. By the way, I think that's a great picture. Sackcloth was a literal thing that you would wear, burlap, where it's purposely uncomfortable, and the reason is to show outwardly that I am mourning. And he says, I wore sackcloth in mourning, but now you have clothed me with gladness instead. I don't know what material gladness is made out of, but it's not burlap, apparently. Verse number 12, watch. To the end that my glory may sing praise to thee and not be silent. O Lord, my God, I will give thanks unto thee forever. David's great day, where he gets to walk out of his room clothed in his new robes and surrounded by people that love him in a nation that God has given to him, in a house that was builded by some other man in some other kingdom that he has made peace with. This great, awesome day that he has had, where David is glorified in front of his people, points to God's goodness. And David lets everybody know that. When God does something great in your life, he does it not maliciously, but he does it for your good, but then he also does it to point people to him. Why did Lazarus die? So that Jesus could raise him from the dead. That was why. Why was the man born blind? Because of this man's sin or his parents? No, so that they could see my glory. Why am I going through this? So that God can give you a new life. So that people might know who he is. God hands us those days on purpose. God handed Lazarus that day for his good and also for his glory. God handed David those difficulties so that one day David could write a psalm and that we could look back on it and in 2023 remind ourselves that when we're going through difficult times, there's another side and God is good and other people can see it in us. Maybe you're going through something difficult because your neighbor's going to, and you're going to be the example of a good God that can walk you through it. Maybe that's why. Well, nobody else is going through something. Well, they might tomorrow. And right now, you are supposed to be the psalmist that points to him. Always for your good and for God's glory. And then lastly, And this is a sad point to end on. But what else I notice in this psalm is simply this, that no valley or mountain lasts. Now, obviously, the mountain on the other side of this life will last forever. But what David does here is that there's a sense of finality to this, right? We know David's story. He went through trials and suffering and caves and loneliness and the weather and war. And now he's king and he's standing in his palace surrounded by his friends and by his subjects. And they love him and this nation has accepted him. And there's peace and there's prosperity. And he's built this palace as a symbol of all the goodness that God has done in their life. And it just feels like the end of the movie, right? And the movie closes, and we have the last score, and the credits run, and they live happily ever after. But we all know that's not the end of David's story. And he even alludes to that here. Look at verse number 6. In my prosperity, I said, I shall never be moved. Look at verse 7 as well. Lord, by thy favor, thou hast made my mountain to stand strong. : Thou didst hide thy face, and I was troubled. You'll have both days. What we want this psalm to say, what we want this message to say, is hard times are now, good times are later. But after a good day, God hands you a difficult day again. No mountain or valley lasts forever. The rest of David's life is still laced with hard times, even as a king, even in this great palace that he can look at and see the goodness of God. The story goes that a farmer is talking to his neighbor and says, yeah, man, my horse ran off. Oh, it's bad luck. He's like, no, it was good luck because the horse ran and he found a whole bunch of wild horses and came back with them all. Oh, it's good luck. No, it's bad luck. My son was training one of the new horses to try to get him broken in, and he kicked him, and he broke his leg. Oh, it's bad luck. No, it's good luck. They came by for a draft for the military, and he wasn't able to be accepted because he had a broken leg. Oh, it's good luck. And the thing is, for each one of those days, oh, it's a good day. Oh, it's a bad day. And God gives you strings of those throughout your life. One thing seems good, and then tomorrow, it's actually God's doing something more than we understand. And there's mountains and valleys. There's ebbs and flows. The tide goes out. The tide comes back in. Take it a day at a time. Take the joys and take the sorrows. I'm done with this psalm. I want you to turn to the book of Ecclesiastes really fast. Brother Conley and I were talking a couple days ago, and he said, give me a definition of surrender. People do that when you're on staff. They just give you like theological questions. Go! Okay. And I was thinking about it for a while, and I wanted to alliterate it, too. So I gave you a definition of surrender. I think surrender in our life implies a lot of different things. He gave a great illustration that it is to tap out. It's to stop fighting. Like when you're wrestling with somebody and there's a conflict, you eventually let them win over you. And I think that manifests itself in a variety of ways in our life. I think the one is agreement. People wrestle with God about right and wrong and truth and error. Most people in this world are not surrendered to the Lord to the extent that they want to live by their definitions of truth instead of God's. They're not surrendered to what God's word has to say because they're too busy trying to live by their own set of doctrines. And so I think it has to do with that. 1 John 1, I talked about that just this morning in my Sunday school class. We have to confess our sin. If we're going to walk in the light, we have to agree with God about the darkness. We can't live by our own definitions. I think it's agreement. I also think it's abiding. One of the truths that we have to recognize is that surrendering to the Lord implies that we can't live the Christian life in our own power either, and we have to yield control to him, because the legalist in the book of Galatians is trying to live the Christian life in his own power and fails. So we have to yield control to God as well. Galatians chapter 5, we see that, of course, in John chapter 15, when he tells us to abide in him, because without him we can do nothing. But I also think surrender has to do with acceptance. A lot of us want to surrender our lives to the Lord, and what we mean by that is, okay, now tell me where to go, and then I'll go there, instead of just receiving the days that God hands to us day by day. Romans chapter 12, verse 1 and 2, it kind of gives us that great picture. If we walk the way we're supposed to walk, then we'll prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God.
And many of us are so busy trying to figure out all the future that we're not just living how we ought to one day at a time and letting God actually orchestrate our own path. Agreement, abiding, and acceptance. And the reason we turn to Ecclesiastes is this is one of my favorite passages about this. Because Ecclesiastes, a lot of people don't like the book because it can be depressing at times. And the reason it's depressing is because it tells us the truth, and we don't always like it. Ecclesiastes, I didn't tell you a chapter, did I? Go to chapter 9 really quickly. Chapter 9, verse number 9. This is interesting. Verse number 9 of chapter 9. Live joyfully with the wife whom thou lovest all the days of thy life, of thy vanity, which he hath given thee under the sun, all the days of thy vanity. That short life that you're grasping for things, he's going to give you a wife, and you're going to enjoy it, and you're going to have a life together. For that is the portion in this life, and in thy labor, which thou hast taken under the sun. Whatsoever thy hand findeth to do, do it with thy might, for there's no work, or device, or knowledge, or wisdom in the grave, whither thou goest. And I returned, and I saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, or the battle to the strong, or yet bread to the wise, or yet riches to men of understanding, or yet favor to men of skill, but time and chance happeneth to them all. For man also knoweth not his time, as the fishes that are taken in an evil net, and as the birds that are caught in the snare, so are the sons of men snared in an evil time when it falleth suddenly upon them. Well, that's not a great way to end. Well, no, this is simply what he's saying. God gives you opportunities. Take advantage of them the best that you can. Whatever your hand finds to do, do with your might. Do the best with what God hands to you, but receive what God hands to you. Because we think, I'm going to earn the life that I want. If I'm strong enough, if I'm smart enough, if I do well enough, then everything should go to me. The race will go to me. The battle will go to me. The days will go to me the way that I've designed. And he says, it's not always that way. But sometimes it is. Sometimes, and throughout the book of Ecclesiastes, he continues to return to this very simple picture. Sitting down at your table at the end of a good work day with your family, eating a good meal. And he tells you to do this. Enjoy it. When God gives you that day, and you get to look around and say, God's been good to me, enjoy the day. And sometimes, the day's not going to be what you expect it to be. And he's going to hand you a completely different day. It didn't make any sense to you. I thought it was strong enough. I thought it was smart enough. I thought it was wise enough. But the battle doesn't always go that way. The race doesn't always go how you think it's going to. Because God is God, and you're not. And surrendering our life to the Lord is partly letting God just be in charge and receiving the days he hands to us. Chapter 3 of Ecclesiastes, we remember that. Sometimes there's a time to weep. Sometimes there's a time to laugh. Sometimes there's a time to build. Sometimes there's time to tear down. Time to gather stones together, pull stones apart, to plant, or to pluck up. God is the one that orchestrates our times. We get to receive it. So that's why we're supposed to live one day at a time. Matthew chapter 6 tells us not to take thought for the morrow, because the morrow will take thought for the things of itself. Sufficient today or the evil thereof. We get to take one day at a time. Why? Because that's how God hands it to you. You never live tomorrow. You always live today. And tomorrow might look way different than you're expecting. But you can rejoice that God is good because you've seen that he is good. And so there is another side to the suffering, but there might be another side to your mountain as well. And that's okay, because we are given the permission and we are given the ability and we are given the instruction to trust him, because we can. So you might be going through something very hard right now. Something, a medical difficulty, a financial trouble, a relational problem. Remember that David, one day he woke up in a palace when one day before that he was waking up in a cave. There's another side to it. But also remember, maybe your days are fine. Maybe you're in the palace today. Maybe you're living in Psalm chapter 30, and you get to go home and you're like, man, God's just taking care of me. Everything is good, and my life is fine, and I almost feel bad about it, but I don't think I should, and God's been good to me. Just remember that God is also good tomorrow when the day doesn't look like that. Joy comes in the morning, not because circumstances are good, but because God is. So we can trust him.